Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Colson Whitehead, whose latest book is titled The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death. Colson Whitehead is the author of 7 books, including Zone 1, Sag Harbor, Apex Hides the Hurt. There's a collection of essays in there as well. This particular book, The Noble Hustle, began as an article for Grantland, which is an online magazine, one of my favorite websites, by the way.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky to work with them.
This book is about your, I guess, adventures in Las Vegas and Atlantic City in the World Series of Poker. It also talks about your own personal life and a little bit about your history as well. You had basically just been playing poker with friends for years, right?
In the 90s, I had a weekly game, $5 buy-in, which seems sort of crazy now, getting people together once a week to do something. But I guess we were young and single and et cetera. And then for the last 12 years, I've had a monthly game that sort of kept me in touch with my friends. It's $5 once a month. It's very social and very low stakes. In Brooklyn, mostly writers, I think, because we're not really sort of cafe writers, and without the monthly hangout, we wouldn't see each other. So it's a good way to keep in touch.
Why did they approach you? How did Grantland approach you?
Well, they were about to launch. They were staffing up. They're funded by ESPN. And my editor, Dan Fearman, was coming from GQ. He'd been recruited. And he liked my fiction. I hadn't done a lot of long-form nonfiction. But in trying to figure out how the magazine would sound, they wanted unexpected voices. And so they contacted me, wanted to know if I wanted to write about sports. And I was like, no, I hate sports. And then they said, do you want to cover the World Series of Poker? And I was like, well, 10 days seems like a long kind of trip. Then they said, what if we, instead of paying you for the article, gave you $10,000 to play in the World Series? And, as someone who loves cards, I couldn't say no. I did love poker, but I never thought I would be at the World Series. So I was very excited. And then I realized that, a home game is not tournament poker. It's a very different beast. There are different betting conventions and way you play and rhythms. So I had to really sort of step up my training for the 6 weeks before I was going to go.
Most of it is Texas Hold'em, which is something that's fairly new. I don't quite understand it.
It's been around since the 70s, got popular in the mid-90s, and definitely the movie Rounders in 1998 brought it to the masses. A lot of the people who play now and are whizzes in their late 30s, saw the movie when they were in their teens and fell in love with the game and wanted to live that sort of Matt Damon outlaw hold'em lifestyle, rubbing up against gangsters and playing in underground games. So it became popular in the late 90s, and then with the rise of televised poker and online poker, it became even bigger.
Did you do any research into the rise of televised poker, how it became popular? Because I remember we never saw it. We'd see golf games, which were unbelievably boring, and, there was baseball, basketball, football, and, various sports, and even extreme sports, which you can watch. But televised poker, you see a guy sitting there squinting, playing with his chips for 5 minutes, and I'm going, why would someone want to watch this?
I've always found it very compelling. The big innovation was in, maybe 2001, 2002, when someone had the bright idea to have a camera that would show the players' down cards, the cards that no one else can see. Before that, yes, it was quite boring, like watching golf or watching baseball with an invisible baseball, even more boring than regular baseball. But, of course, once you can see the card, you can participate in the action, you can have commentators, and, to make up for those stretches when a guy's just sort of thinking about whether he should bet or fold, they have commentators making jokes and keeping the action going. But that was huge, and a lot of the people who play now and are winning the World Series, they're in their early 20s, and they started watching televised poker when they were like 12 and admiring the players they now have supplanted.
Well, in The Noble Hustle, Colson Whitehead, you also talk about online poker, which is now illegal, that there were a couple of companies that did online poker, and people got pretty good playing online.
Yeah, I mean, it was a crash course in how to play. The old cowboy players would spend decades on the road, traveling from town to town, honing their skills. And when online sites came, anyone with a web connection could start playing 10 games at once, and you would cram 20 years of experience into a year and a half. And so it was kids who were too young to play, people playing with credit card advances, and there were all sorts of money shenanigans, people skimming money off the top, and they were shut down. Luckily for me, a month before I started my journey, so I couldn't actually go online myself and had to go to brick-and-mortar casinos in Atlantic City.
It almost feels like a George Plimpton-ish thing. You know, you play touch football and suddenly you're in the NFL. Did you kind of feel that?
A home player going to the World Series. Grantland's idea was that, they like my writing and they were hoping I would have a unique perspective as an outsider. And definitely as someone who grew up reading George Plimpton or Norman Mailer, Tom Wolfe, I admired the guys who wrote nonfiction and used the techniques of fiction to write their articles. And so playing with structure, playing with voice, inserting yourself into the story, that was very normal for me, having grown up in the 80s reading stuff like In Cold Blood or various Hunter S. Thompson stuff.
So you have to get yourself an expert to teach you, and you found someone, and she was really good.
Yeah, a woman named Helen Ellis, who's a writer. I only meet writers these days because I don't get out much. So she's a friend of a friend, and she has the effect of a proper Southern lady. She has this great accent. At the poker table, she wears a black sweater and pearls. So her persona is housewife. If you engage her in conversation at the table and ask her what she does, she'll say, "Oh, I'm a housewife," and be really sort of quiet. And then as the men, it's a male-dominated game, condescend to her, she, takes their money. So we met in Union Square, and I told her, I played $5 games, and she gave me a squint. But nonetheless, took me under her wing, telling me where to play in Atlantic City, the right books to read for tournament poker, and just giving me advice from her various journeys. So it became a weird sort of blind side or driving Miss situation where she's like, a proper Southern white lady. I'm a weird black guy. And she's like teaching me like how to navigate this new social sphere.
You bring that part up now. You mentioned it a little bit in the book that you're the dreadlocked black guy. Are most of the people white? I remember several years ago, there was a casino, an Indian casino that opened up in the Bay Area, and I went with a friend just to see what it was like. We walked in, everybody there was Asian except for a few ex-hippies. What was it like in Atlantic City and Vegas? What was the demographic makeup?
It's mostly the average guy in a casino and the average guy to World Series is sort of a paunchy, middle-aged white guy, has some disposable income, or is serious about the game and spends 9 months on the circuit traveling around. The demographics have been shifting the last couple of years. There are a lot of young players who grew up on internet play, and they play a much more aggressive game. I call them the Robotrons, and they're wearing their hoodies and sunglasses and have their earbuds in, listening to death metal or self-help books, and they play a very sort of frenetic game. But, it's mostly white, mostly male. Most of the, top female players have a sort of tomboy look as opposed to Helen, who sort of plays up her suburban glam lifestyle.
This is pre-Hurricane Sandy, right?
Yes, spring of 2011.
Had you been to Atlantic City?
I'd gone, twice before with buddies on, a weekend road trip. But in order to, cram as much experience in as I could, I had to go to Port Authority. I'd drop off my daughter at school and tell the other parents I was going to gamble, and they'd sort of frown at me. And then hop on a bus to Atlantic City. And there are tournaments all day, so I would play one, wash out, take a cab across town to play a 2 o'clock one, play a 4 o'clock one, and then hop on this bus at midnight and come back to the city around 3 a.m.
Were you kind of concerned that you might blow the 10 grand?
Well, I never saw it. The check went directly from ESPN to Caesars Resorts International. I spent my own money on buses and tournaments. People were like, it's for work. You can actually write it off on your taxes. But I wasn't about to put, $65 tournament, Caesars Casino. I'm already flagged by the IRS for deducting all my books and stuff like that. I didn't want to make it too easy for them.
And you've got a poker face, right?
Well, just from birth, genetics, whatever, formative experiences. People have always said I have a good poker face. They'll know what I'm saying. I feel half dead most of the time, so I think my low emotional my barren emotional inner landscape helps. And if you have a blank face, people just project things onto you. And so I'm just at the table thinking about mistakes I made 20 years ago or why I'm so unhappy. And people think like, oh, he must have a huge hand because he's so expressionless. Meanwhile, I'm just miserable. But it helps at the poker table, if not life.
What about watching other people's tells? I mean, is that different? You're hanging out in Brooklyn with your writer pals, and you kind of look at them, and you know when one guy has a great hand because he raises one eyebrow or whatever. Everybody knows it. He knows it, too, but he can't stop, you know, that kind of thing. Then you go to Atlantic City or Vegas, and what do you see? Can you get a read? Can you try to be psychic?
At a certain point, you know, I met a player named Matt Matros, who's won a few big events at the World Series. He was sort of coaching me, and I was like, I just want to last a few days and have some good material for my article. And he was like, well, you've been studying the game for 6 weeks. Like, maybe instead of just reporting, look around you, play, and, you know, there might be a moment when you have a read on somebody that goes against sort of common sense, but you sort of know it in your gut. And maybe that makes your trip worthwhile, not the article, just sort of being in the game in a new way. And there are a few moments, you know, once I sort of settled down where that happened, and it really was wonderful. In Hollywood movies, you see the tells, and, you know, the villain, like, blinks furiously when he has aces. At the table, it's not as dramatic, and you're thinking of a lot of a whole constellation of things. It's their demeanor, but also their betting patterns, just how they bet over time, round to round and level to level. It's you trying to psych them out and figuring out how to outplay their range of hands. It's the temperament at the table, where you are in the tournament. So there's so many different factors that I was just astounded that they keep track of, and I was just, you know, trying to juggle all that at once in my sort of amateur way.
And it also means that you can't create any patterns yourself in how you bet either. I mean, everybody's trying to avoid patterns.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're running a game across years. I mean, if you play someone at the main event or different casino events, they know how you play, you know how they play, and over time you have to think about how can I outwit Tupelo Slim. You know, he's been beating me all these years. You're bluffing, you're laying traps, you know, you're thinking on day two of the main event I'll start playing this way and reverse how I've been doing it up to now. So there's a lot of higher level, you know, chess-like gamesmanship going on.
You went to Atlantic City how many times? Like 3 times before you went to Vegas?
Oh, no, a bunch of times. If I could, I would go like 3 times a week.
Oh, really?
You know, I had my daughter, so I couldn't, you know, go as much.
You never took her, though.
No. Well, I mean, I had to leave her at the curb because, you know. So, no, but she was with me in spirit. The year before, I'd been writing Zone 1, and I was a solo parent, a divorced dad, and so we had our own sort of shtick going on. So leaving for 10 days to go to Las Vegas was a huge thing for me. Thinking of her and the sort of good luck token she gave me kept me kind of grounded when I was surrounded by all these, you know, real poker players.
There's a small section in there about an earlier trip to Vegas, actually a big road trip that you took with your pals Darren and Dan back in your college days or right after college that I found really fascinating because you examine what it was like to be in Vegas then, which was the 90s, compared to what it's like now. Also, Dan turns out to be one of the big CGI guys, and your pal Darren, who at that point was just a slacker.
Yeah, we're all slackers. Yes, yeah.
Crashing at a drug dealer's house in Berkeley, wound up being Darren Aronofsky, who is the director of Black Swan, Noah, and Requiem for a Dream, and some weird thing called The Fountain. At that point, in hanging out with him, was there any sense that you had that this was a guy who was going to hit it and hit it big in a weird way because he's an auteur and makes big-budget movies?
No, I mean, he was intense and had his own, you know, sort of persona back then. But no, we were all the sort of slackers, prime examples of Generation X. We drove across country. We were writing for a student-run travel guide, Let's Go, and that's how we went to Las Vegas. And so we wrote about Circus and Excalibur, the sort of corny theme casinos that were big then. 25 years later, you know, it's much more corporate, commercial. It's not just for gamblers. You go there to have a spa weekend, eat good food, go shopping. And so the leisure industrial complex, as I call it, has become just more efficient and smarter about bringing people in and not breaking them. You know, they don't want you to be bankrupt. They want you to come back and have fun next year and stay in the casino and cash in your reward points. 25 years is a long time, and Darren found his voice in film. Dan, the computer graphics guy, was a cartoonist. He moved from sort of paper animation to computers, and then I started writing. But we were all just, you know, just dreamers with, you know, horrible ideas for scripts and books and cartoons. And in the same way that sort of Vegas has grown up, you know, we eventually found our footing.
You're listening to an interview with Colson Whitehead, whose latest book is titled The Noble Hustle. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. What school did you guys go to?
Harvard.
Do you think going to an elite Ivy League school, do you think that opens doors, or do you think that being smart guys opened the doors?
Well, I think being weird guys with, you know, and sticking true to our visions, you know, was sort of more important. You know, when I was in college, I auditioned for the creative writing classes at Harvard, and I was turned down like each time. You know, I was a terrible writer. But despite that, I was going to keep going on with it. And Darren's movie, you know, his student film, was very eccentric and influenced by like, David Lynch and the sort of rise of indie filmmaking in the early 90s. You wouldn't look at it and say, oh, yeah, this guy is, you know, going to go on things. So there's a point in the book where on that first trip to Vegas, we go to a place called the House of Jerky, which is a sort of a wonderland we stumbled upon. A guy just had a dream to sell beef jerky, you know, ostrich jerky, Alaskan salmon jerky. I sort of jokingly say it's, you know, a tribute to his own vision. You want to open a house of jerky? Open it. So in that way, in that trip, we were all sort of gamblers dreaming about hitting it big in our own individual games. As Vegas has sort of grown up, we sort of, and found its vision, we sort of found our vision too.
Well, that brings up an interesting question about the nature of gambling. You can't get into a writing course and you gamble that you're a writer. I can understand kind of gambling if you're a filmmaker because you have no choice. But gambling, do you think there's a relationship between taking chances at the poker table and success off the poker table?
Well, you have to believe in hope. You have to be a romantic. You know, we talked about skill before and the different kind of things you juggle when you're a high-functioning poker player. But you also need luck. No matter how good you are, you're hoping that the next card will be the seven of clubs that you need for your royal flush. You're hoping to get that third seven that makes the trips. Even if you've had a huge run of bad luck for weeks or months or years at the tables, you have to have that hope that you're going to make it, that the poker gods are going to smile upon you and reverse your fortunes. Obviously, compulsive gamblers have a different relationship to hope than the people I sort of talk about in the book, you know, just your middle-class dudes who love poker and want to go to the World Series. But there is that element of romance that keeps you going.
Why do you think there are mostly men there?
It's a macho game. You're proving yourself. You're showing you're down. You're going all in. You know, you're sort of dropping your manhood on the table when you push all your chips across. You know, what made online poker so interesting is that it allowed female players who might be intimidated by, you know, the all-male casinos to play anonymously online. And so, you know, some people have estimated that at the height of online poker, a third of the players were female. In a casino, at the same time, you know, it's still 95% or 90% male. You know, it's about the games you grow up with. There aren't a lot of black players.
Did you get any prejudice when you were in either place? Anybody say anything other than, oh, cool hair?
No, I mean, you expect it to be sort of crusty, but it's not. It's dentists with disposable money who are coming to the World Series of Poker and young guys who, you know, have different racial attitudes and Gen Xers and baby boomers. Nothing to my face. I had my own sort of baggage playing with these hardcore poker players. But as the World Series went on and I played with them at the main event and they washed out and I washed out and we had various encounters, they really are just guys who love poker, and they've taken a week off from work, left their jobs or families to come and fulfill their dream of playing in the World Series of Poker, which they wanted to do for many years. In the end, you know, we're all just like people who love cards, and they love cards more than I do. They're making, you know, they're very serious, but they're just like dudes with mortgages and leaky roofs.
Were you open about, A, that you were Colson Whitehead, who had several novels to your credit, and B, that you were writing for ESPN's Grantland magazine?
No, I mean, my fame is, you know, quite compact, you could say. You know, one of the conceits of the book is that it's the World Series of Poker, so what nation do I represent? And the joke is that I represent the Republic of anhedonia. Anhedonia meaning, from psychology, meaning the inability to feel pleasure. So I saw myself as a representative of this nation of sort of losers and sad sacks and melancholy types. So I got a sweatshirt that said my country's name on it, the Republic of Anhedonia, and you know, has some lightning bolts and looks pretty dandy. So I wore that at the tables. And, of course, no one asked what it meant or why I was wearing it, but it made me feel good. And I think, you know, the persona of, like, the urban neurotic in the book is informed by, you know, 70s comedians and 80s comedians. I definitely relate. People who complain, who love New York, complain about it, have all sorts of, like, first world complaints that, you know, don't really apply to most of the world. I encountered that at an early age, and I think that sort of comedian's persona is in this book, hopefully.
Colson Whitehead, you do the World Series of Poker. We won't say how it comes out. I mean, we kind of figure we know in advance how it's going to end.
Surely.
You know, because otherwise you probably wouldn't be here writing this book. Or maybe you would.
You know, if I had won $8 million, which is what the dude won the year I went, I probably would still be traveling around the world and snorkeling and eating fine cheese and wine somewhere. But I would write the book because, you know, that's what I do.
You come back and you write the essay for Grantland, and then you decide to turn it into a book. What were the issues, the problems that arose that you necessarily didn't think were going to arise in trying to take this journey and turn it into a book?
There was a lot of stuff that didn't fit into the article. I wasn't paid for it. My money, my article fee went to my entrance fee. And I think if I had been paid, it probably would have been like 10 pages. But since I was writing for free, why not write a 70-page article? That's sort of how I think, because I'm sort of stupid. So, you know, I want to elaborate on how tournaments work and the rules of poker and follow some people around on the circuit. The hardest part, actually, was I was sort of in a bummed-out mood when I went to the World Series of Poker. And then 2 years later, when I was expanding it, I was in a different place and was much happier. So in keeping a consistent voice with the earlier parts of the book, I had to sort of impersonate who I was 2 years before. You know, whenever you write a book over the course of years, you have a consistent narrative voice that you maintain and, you know, you course correct. So in this time, I actually had to pretend to be who I was 2 years before and get back into that sense of humor and sensibility.
The previous book, Zone One, which I'd like to talk a little bit about, is about the aftermath of zombies in New York. And obviously, when I'm thinking of people at a poker table in Vegas, a part of me is thinking, oh, this is a sequel. Did that ever cross your mind?
Well, not so much poker table because you're engaged and you're keeping track of people. But as you walk from the front door on the way to the poker tables, you just see these, you know, mechanical robots at the slot machines going click, 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 click. You know, it's a very robotic choreography they're engaged in. And they're not speaking. They're sort of staring blindly ahead. And they are zombies.
So that did cross your mind.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to Zone One. What are the origins? I know that you grew up reading comic books and, you know, loved George Romero and all of that. But what prompted you to say, okay, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to write a literary zombie novel.
You know, it was a change of pace. And I do sort of switch genre from book to book, so it keeps it sort of fresh for me. In this case, I grew up, you know, reading Stephen King and spending warm summer days on my couch watching Twilight Zone. So I wanted to salute, you know, the fantasy and science fiction and horror authors who made me want to write in the first place. And then my family, we had cable very early. If we had cable, we'd have to talk to each other. So I was always seeing, like, movies before it was age appropriate. And I saw Dawn of the Dead very early, and it stuck with me. And I had, for many years, until I wrote the book, zombie dreams, zombie anxiety dreams. Depending on what was going on in my life, I'd be alone or with a plucky human band or pursued by fast zombies, slow zombies. And once a month for, like, 30 years, I had zombie horror dreams. So I wanted to address why that was, where it was coming from. And I guess, you know, people have different theories about what zombies are in the same way that people have ideas about vampires and what they mean in different cultural contexts. For me, it's about a fear of other people, the horror that your family, your friends, your neighbors can suddenly stop pretending that they're not monsters and then come after you seem to be like a nice sort of neurotic, paranoid fear that I was cultivating. So exploring that and then figuring out how I feel about New York and what it is to be a survivor. you know, after 9/11, as a New Yorker, I had to figure out how I could translate my pre-9/11 hometown persona or, you know, character or life personality into a post-9/11 world. And how do you come back from a catastrophe, whether it's the apocalypse or a tornado or a personal thing, a personal setback or a terrorist attack? So the book is partially about trauma and coming back from disasters.
Well, where were you on that day, on September 11th?
I was in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, and, you know, heard about the first plane, went out to the park to, you know, see what was happening, and saw the second tower come down, and obviously it was very traumatic. So how do you come back from a disaster? Part of the book is trying to figure that out using zombies as a metaphor.
At the same time, of course, we're going through a zombie revival, particularly with Walking Dead, Resident Evil, you know, World War Z, certainly, but a whole list of various kinds of zombie films, books. Obviously, horror is some level a metaphor for what we're all going through. What do you think is the reason behind the zombie explosion?
It's hard for me to say. It's hard for me to step back and figure out how other people are using it. For me, seeing like Night of the Living Dead with its black protagonist made a big impression on me. Black survivor lynched by a white mob at the end obviously speaks to American history. So, but people who grew up on 28 Days Later and Fast Zombies and The Walking Dead, you know, I find it hard to see what their fear they're articulating. For me, it's about other people. But, you know, college kids, they have zombie walks where they'll get like 1,000 people dressed as zombies and go through town. I have no idea like where that comes from. I have my own interpretation. And then how does somebody who grew up with 40 years of zombie pop culture deal with them? You know, there are humorous approaches and more terrifying approaches. It comes in every week. You can stream it from The Walking Dead. I can only sort of, you know, speak for myself. Other people, as usual, are sort of beyond me.
The other element of Zone 1, it's a post-apocalyptic society, and that's another trend that seems to be going on through our culture, not the kind of destruction there that you would see in a film like Godzilla or every single superhero movie that destroys Manhattan. There were a few in the 70s, a few disaster movies, but they didn't have the utter destruction that we're seeing now. And, you know, then you combine that with Cormac McCarthy's The Road and all the post-apocalypse. What do you think is going on there?
I think the 70s cycle is interesting because just as a New Yorker, seeing Planet of the Apes and seeing my city destroyed, you know, I'm like 7 and seeing this and having my mind blown of seeing the Statue of Liberty poking out of the sand. There was Omega Man with Charlton Heston. He's cruising around empty Los Angeles. Escape from New York, and even Death Wish is a, you know, post-apocalyptic New York, because New York in the 70s was the apocalypse. So in terms of cultural anxieties, you know, I can't say. For me, you know, the ruined landscape, the ruined city sort of speaks to me. I think growing up in a kind of ruined New York, I feel like there's, all, you know, we can always sort of fall back into an apocalyptic state the way things were like in the 70s at the height of heroin or, you know, crack epidemics. And fiscal collapse. So, I mean, I think there is a, you know, there's a sense that people feel that we can slip into disaster quite easily. And as social structures fail, what happens next and how do we survive and move on?
Is it easier to write social commentary using a horror novel or in the context of a trip to Vegas to play poker?
Zombies are a metaphor, you know, for people and human interaction in the same way that the elevators in my first book, The Intuitionist, are a rhetorical device to talk about society. The Noble Hustle is really trying to have fun and have more jokes per page than usual and have fun with the voice, which is sort of despairing but funny. And, you know, I think there's sort of absurd turns of thought in the book. It just felt very different because, for me, it's a very fast, colloquial, vernacular book in a way that, you know, my fiction isn't, you know, a lot of the time. So it was just a real blast to do.
You think it's more fun to write then?
I had to figure out, you know, the nonfiction structure, and then, like, there's the more difficult part of explaining, like, poker concepts to a lay audience and finding metaphors and analogies to explain things to people who hate poker. You know, if you hate poker, I think you can still like the book and appreciate, you know, the exposure of this subculture. So that was hard. You know, I think anytime when you switch genres like the way I do or other people do, you have to find your way in, and that's always difficult, you know, find the right voice or structure to tell the story.
In an interview with Rumpus, you said, I don't think there's any obligation for a writer to make the world a better place, nor is it a writer's idea to necessarily have a story. I write the books that I feel compelled to write. What does that mean?
I felt compelled to write Zone One. It seemed to sort of speak to my attitude, you know, towards life at that point. And when I wrote Sag Harbor, which was much more personal, I had enough distance from who I was as a teenager to, you know, use fiction to shape those experiences and find a way to hopefully translate my teenage point of view to other people. So, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, if I won $1 million, I might not necessarily be here because I'd be off surfing or something. But the experience was so important that I was compelled to, you know, to make the article into a short book. Does the artist have an obligation to write a certain kind of thing? I mean, if you want to write 10 books about daffodils and that's your thing, be the daffodil writer guy. In terms of speaking to the concerns of the culture and talking about how the way people live, you know, that is one of my concerns, and it's more present in some books than others. But I don't feel you have an obligation to anybody. You know, you're an artist. Do what you want to do that makes you happy and sort of completes you in a way that nothing else sort of completes you.
Were you having conversations like that with Darren and Dan about the nature of art, or were you just kind of saying, you know, what are we having for dinner?
No, it's more like, yo, why don't you put the Clash back on? No, I mean, we talked about our goofball ideas for stories, but we had no idea how to tell a story. We knew we had something to say. We had no sort of tools to get it out there. You know, Dan and Darren work together. Dan does special effects for a lot of movies, but all of Darren's movies, and they have an office together. And another friend of mine is an executive producer for Darren's movies and writes some of them. That collaboration that you're talking about happened later. When you do film, you do have to sort of talk to each other and work together to get your vision across. Of course, loner writer guy. I have a sort of different route.
Have you thought about doing screenplays?
Whenever I do, I get like 10 pages in, and I'm like, this is hard. I'd rather write a novel instead. It's a different form, and I haven't spent enough time, you know, trying to master it. And inevitably, I realize that screenwriting is sort of a form of procrastination. It's a nice month where I'm thinking of finding ways to put off writing the novel, which is what I do, basically.
Well, something like The Noble Hustle could easily become a film.
You know, I think in the book I talk about how it's like a sports film, but it's a 70s sports film, which always ends up, you know, with a downbeat ending and the hero struggling against personal constraints, societal constraints, and then missing the final touchdown or whatever. You know, it's definitely linear and funny. I'm not sure what kind of hero I make personally, but...
Colson Whitehead, what are you working on now?
I take a year off, you know, between books and, you know, recharge. So now that the book tour is winding down, I'm going to start another novel, historical novel. So I have to get off my butt and do research, unfortunately. You know, my last two books have just been, like, the research has consisted of watching 70s horror films, and before that, with Sag Harbor, watching 80s hip-hop videos. So I'm going to have to, like, dig deep again, and, you know, I'm sort of older and have less energy.
What's the era?
I can't say. I'm getting older and more superstitious, but it should be fun, I hope.
You've been listening to an interview with Colson Whitehead, whose latest book is titled The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.